The Russians have launched a new missile. It is a nuclear-tipped missile. It is a nuclear-armed and driven missile, something that has never been seen before. And we're trying to figure out exactly what this means, how effective it may be, and how is that going to change the strategic environment within the Western world and the world at large. And to try and make some sense out of some of this today, we are very grateful to have Dmitry Polyansky, first deputy permanent representative to Russia, to the United Nations, really glad to have you back on here. Thank you very much for coming on today, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
Well, listen, one of the reasons we appreciate having you come on is because you don't pull any punches. You don't usually give us any mumbo jumbo. You just tell us what the truth is on something, whether it's something we might like to hear or not. And it's kind of refreshing today. So we're actually, especially in the diplomatic corps, grateful to have that. So let's just get right into it. So what is this missile? And actually, a better question is first is why did Russia feel with all of the strategic missiles that it is already has in its inventory, already the largest in the world, why does Russia need a new one?
Well, first of all, for those who follow development of our missile program, they would notice that this missile, Burevestnik, was announced like maybe 3-4 years ago. So it was even before the start of our special military operation, there was a presentation. And these three new types of missiles, I think, or four types, were announced. And some of them have already been used, like the Kinjal ballistic missile, which is very efficient. The battlefield is now being used. And Burevestnik was announced back then. It was only, you know, modeled by the computer, so there was a computer presentation. And today, as far as I understand, we have conducted the first test of this missile, which proved to be very efficient because this missile has absolutely no limits in terms of the distance, because it is being powered by a nuclear fuel, and also it is absolutely it can't be intercepted by the current air missile and anti-air missile systems. So it's absolutely invincible, and I think that's something that is being acknowledged by a lot of military experts right now. It's of course a big development. Again, it was announced before, and it shows that we are very much advanced in terms of hypersonic missiles technology, something that even our American counterparts have to admit. So it's a logic development of our missile program that has happened right now. And this is a signal that, you know, that there are a lot of claims that Russian economy is in tatters, that we're not capable of creating something new, that we are disassembling washing machines in order to make more drones and missiles. And I think that's the best response to those who claim that Russia is not a serious power in terms of military development. Also, this is a signal that we are ready to engage in further arms control measures, but it takes two to tango. So far, the Americans have not indicated any clue that they are ready to dance along with us. You know, there is a proposal made by President Putin to extend voluntarily the term of implementation of the START 3 treaty, regardless of the fact that it is due to expire in February next year. And provided, of course, the American counterparts act in the same way. But so far, we haven't got anything concrete, some interest displayed, but that's it. So I imagine that's also a response to all those who say that Russia is vulnerable in this regard, and we're saying that we're ready for any scenarios. We would prefer peaceful ones, and we would prefer, of course, arms control treaties to be extended, but it's not only up to us to decide this, and if there is no desire on the other side, that's what we have to do.
Now, there were some reports that came out after the last Trump-Putin phone call, the one that lasted 2.5 hours, and actually not just reports, it was statements by Trump himself that he said part of the discussions were not merely what was going on with the special military operation and the war in Ukraine, but that it talked about other things with strategic issues like this one you're talking about here with the New START expiration coming up in February, or even in business opportunities later. What is the Russian position? That was just kind of a cryptic things that were said, but as far as you can release anyway, what was said by President Putin to Trump in terms of what did he want to actually get done on a strategic treaty?
Well, in terms of strategic treaty, I think it's quite obvious that we need some kind of a serious signal of U.S. interests to engage in this kind of action of further arms control. So far, nothing on practice, just words by President Trump, but they haven't materialized in anything concrete at the level of those who actually engage on such issues. That's why actually, we everything is clear, I think, more or less, of how our future relations may look like, how the peace settlement in Ukraine may look like. We discussed extensively this scenario in Anchorage. There were certain understandings which were, I think, confirmed during this phone conversation between Trump and Putin. And that's what we are basing upon in our future planning and moves. But again, so far on the ground, there have been not many results of this engagement.
So what is the Russian objective? In a perfect world, in engaging with your American counterparts, President Trump, what would Putin want to say? Here's what the outcome would look like that they want to work towards terms of its new start.
The outcome of new start or the outcome of Ukrainian
new
crisis?
Start.
Well, the new start, we need to extend the treaty. The treaty expires in February, and so far there has been no preparatory work, and you know that it takes certain time for experts to prepare for the extension. It might be ratified, I think, should be ratified as a treaty, if I'm not mistaken. So far, nothing has happened, only words. Some of them are quite encouraging words, but no practical steps. So the first move, in order to save something that remains of arms control architecture, would be to agree on the extension of the START, of the new START treaty, and we are not yet there. So the moves that the measures that I mentioned announced by President Putin, they are not about extending START treaty. So if it goes as it goes, it will expire in February. The move that President Putin announced is to continue voluntarily as a gesture of goodwill to honor the commitments of the START treaty, provided for 1 year, provided U.S. side acts in the same way. And in the meantime, maybe it will be enough time for our experts to meet together and to grope for possible new ways of concluding treaties on arms control, whatever is related to this, in the meantime, while this voluntary measures would be in place. That was the idea, but so far it wasn't matched by anything.
And what do you say to those critics who say, well, obviously Russia is not interested at all in having any kind of a new strategic limitations? That's the reason they just came out with this new missile here. So they're trying to expand it and make it more dangerous. They don't actually want it to have a negotiated settlement.
Again, I can refer to the fact that this missile was announced about 4 years ago. So it's not something that was totally new. Its test is something that is totally new, but it's a logic development of what we announced several years ago. So I don't think it should be viewed as something brand new at this stage.
And so would the Russians then, in, let's just say that at some point we do get concurrence from both sides and they do send in nuclear experts to negotiate some kind of terms, would the Russians, at least theoretically, negotiate away that in exchange for some commensurate reduction on the U.S. side?
Well, I'm not an expert there, and I don't know where we stopped our negotiations. I think there are a lot of things to get busy with on the table, provided both sides provide necessary resolve to abort them. Maybe these issues will also be part of discussions. I don't know. It's not up to me to decide. But in the absence of any moves, of course, we are free to take any measures we think would strengthen our security and would defend our interests in the world.
Now, there was this televised statement that was released from President Putin talking to General Gerasimov on the issues of the Burevestnik and in terms of its capabilities. Watch this.
I am talking about the test of the Burevestnik cruise missile with a nuclear power plant that no one else in the world has. Comrade Supreme Commander, such a test was conducted on October 21st. That a multi-hour flight of this rocket was carried out, which it covered a distance of 14,000 kilometers. And this is not the limit. With a nuclear engine? Yes, with a nuclear engine. And the tactical and technical characteristics of the Burevestnik missile generally allow it to be used with guaranteed accuracy against highly protected objects at any distance. And thus its high capabilities for bypassing missile and air defense systems were demonstrated.
So now, if, from what I can understand anyway, this is not a hypersonic like the Kinzhals and some of the others you mentioned.
No, it's not a hypersonic.
So it's a subsonic. Wouldn't that then make it capable of being shot down?
Well, I'm not a military man, so it's hard for me to give you the details, to give you more details. But as far as I understand, all the military experts agree with the fact that this it's impossible to intercept this missile for many reasons, and nobody except us possesses at this stage any system that would intercept these missiles.
And so I understand you said a minute ago that this has been like 4 years since even the computer version of it was announced that was in the simulation, yep. But now it's in this. But then the question is, if Russia already has the largest nuclear stockpile in the world already and the nuclear triad of its own, why would it need a new variant? How does that actually help Russian security?
Well, one thing is the number of nuclear warheads that you are mentioning, but the other thing is how to deliver them, how to be sure of the fact that we will be able to make a defensive strike which will neutralize those who want bad to our country. And I think that this missile fits very, very, very well this purpose.
And presumably then that the intent, at least the overarching intent, is to increase the deterrent value by the Russian nuclear arsenal. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. But again, I'm not a military expert. I'm a diplomat, so I can only judge from the same pictures that you just showed us.
So if that was the intent, then one would imagine that that's why anyone would come up with a new missile to make it less likely that it ever has to be used. But it doesn't seem to at least rhetorically be having an effect on the intended target, which is President Trump. Because when asked about this, he talked about how, yeah, I've got my own submarine, so I don't need one of those.
Russia said this week that they tested a new missile that can go more than 8,000 miles. Is that saber-rattling for you? What is that?
They know we have a nuclear submarine, the greatest in the world, right off their shores. So, I mean, it doesn't have to go 8,000 miles. And, they're not playing games with us. We're not playing games with them either. We test missiles all the time. But, you know, we do have a nuclear submarine. We don't need to go 8,000 miles. And I don't think it's an appropriate thing for Putin to be saying either, by the way. He ought to get the war ended. That's what he ought to do instead of testing missiles.
So this is not the first time that President Trump has mentioned nuclear-powered submarines off the coast of Russia. What does this do in deterrence to Russia?
I frankly have no idea. There are different opinions about this, but I hope he knows what he's speaking about. And hope that there are people around him that really can advise him in the right way what U.S. is facing with and what is U.S. facing and what might be the consequences of neglecting such things. But again, there are enough of clever people, I hope, around him who can, who have his ear and who have maybe a best capacity and knowledge to advise him in the right way.
And what, I mean, what do you think is the right way? Or what is the message from that saber-rattling talk?
The right way would be to engage in, to re-engage in the meaningful consultations on arms control and maybe non-proliferation, not from the condescending stance that U.S. was taking many years previously, but from realistic stance. Again, it's up to the Americans to decide, of course. Again, it takes two to tango, and we're not dancing at this stage at all.
Yeah, and that's not good for anybody in the world, actually, on either side. So we're a big advocate in this channel, both for Russia and the United States, to get together to talk about nuclear reduction, because anything else means it's going to send up in an arms race, which is bad for everybody. The other thing that he mentioned in that clip right there, I want to talk about, because that also is, it has a more near term issue. And that's he lectured that Putin should just worry about ending this war here. He should just stop it. Now, President Trump has recently said, you know, I think that we should just stop it right where we're at. We should just quit fighting on the current line of contact and everybody basically go home and just call it an end of the day. But your boss, Sergei Lavrov, I think it was yesterday, said that's a little bit odd because of the people need to understand what he said was the history of this idea to get to a ceasefire.
The 16th of August, when he came back to Washington from Alaska, and he said it was determined by all that the best way to end the horrific war between Russia and Ukraine is to go directly to a peace agreement, which would end the war, and not a mere ceasefire agreement. This is key. He answered to all those who were, since the beginning of spring this year, they radically changed their rhetoric. Before, they were saying no cessation of hostilities, Russia must be defeated, strategic defeat, and so on and so forth. Then, as of spring, about that time, they started saying immediate ceasefire without any precondition. Yeah. When people now say nothing but a ceasefire, immediate ceasefire, and then history would judge. It's a very radical change.
And I'd actually like to expand a little bit on that, because I'm really interested from a Russian perspective, how in a negotiating perspective, especially. You had President Trump first came into office and said, 24 hours, I'm going to have this war wrapped up. I know Putin, I know Zelensky, we're going to get this done. And then that 24 hours turned into, all right, well, 100 days. And then it turned into 50 days. And then it said, all right, there's going to be a deal in 10 days, or I'm going to have all these sanctions. And then that just went away. That led into Alaska. And then it was shortly thereafter, after the Alaska didn't result in anything, that he says, you know what? Ukraine can go to the 1991 borders. They can just go all the way, maybe even take into Russia itself. And then all of a sudden it was back again to having some negotiations. And then what, a week or two ago, he said, okay, we'll just stop right here. How does Russia understand what is the condition and the objective of the U.S. side when the goalpost keeps moving so radically? How do you deal with that?
Well, it's sometimes very hard to analyze the very mercurial U.S. foreign policy, and I don't think it's our task to do it. It's up to U.S. to understand what the United States finally wants from this settlement. But our position has been clear and consistent all the time. We were saying, and as you rightly said, at a certain point, President Trump was echoing what we were saying in terms of the fact that a mere ceasefire will not stop this war. Because we were there already. We had the Minsk agreements, which were kind of a ceasefire and freezing the conflict between Ukraine and people in the east of Ukraine, and there were a clear roadmap, was a clear roadmap of what Ukraine needs to do to get these regions back. Ukraine did absolutely nothing, only the opposite. And as we know from the revelations of Angela Merkel and François Hollande, who were directly participating in this exercise, that this was a mere smokescreen to prepare Ukraine for the war with Russia. So we say that this conflict has a certain history and has a lot of root causes, which brought us where we are right now. And If somebody has a standpoint that history starts on the 24th of February 2022, I don't think that we can discuss anything with this person, because for him nothing happened before that. They say that it was allegedly an unprovoked aggression, blah blah blah, all these things. But for those who understand that there were a lot of moves that led up to the situation where we are right now, then they will understand that there are root causes which should be addressed and eliminated if we want a settlement. And their root causes were actually the same in the context of the Minsk agreements. And Ukrainian side and its sponsors did nothing to abort these root causes. So we're absolutely aware of the fact that they will not do it now. If there is a ceasefire, they will do nothing. Moreover, I would say that there are a lot of Western politicians who do not conceal the facts that the moment there is a ceasefire, they will spend every effort to rearm Ukraine, to prepare it for the resumption of war with Russia, to help it to heal its wounds. And the question is, why do we need this kind of a ceasefire when the Russian army has total initiative on all the fronts? The question is open. So at some point, President Trump, as far as it seemed to us, and I hope it is still the same situation, he had very good understanding of these reasons. And he said, as you quoted, that a mere ceasefire is not enough. There should be sustainable long-term settlement. And there are certain conditions for this settlement. And we're still at this position. As far as I know, that the spirit of Alaska was confirmed in the last conversation that you mentioned between President Putin and President Trump. So we still act on the assumption that the U.S. position remains the same. We'll see how it unfolds, of course, but we don't have any reasons to believe otherwise.
Now, there are certainly other voices in the United States that have access to President Trump's ear, which are giving him a very different message. And one of the most, powerful and relentless is retired General Jack Graham, who says he thinks that Trump needs to just take the gloves off with Russia.
So where are we now? President's taken the gloves off. He said, I've had enough of this extended diplomacy. I've run out of patience with Putin. I've given him as much rope as possible. I think this is the beginning. And yes, these are real sanctions. Everyone who's looked at it knows that they are. They have to be enforced. It takes enormous vigilance on the part of the Treasury and the State Department to make sure it's working. And he's got a bunch of other sanctions in the quiver, not the least of which is sending Lindsey Graham and Senator Blumenthal's proposed legislation, which would slap 500% tariffs on anybody right. purchasing Russian oil. And so, the president has, you know, that whole ghost fleet out there of tankers. The president can go after that. So he's got more to do on the sanction area.
So let's look at the last part of his comment there first, because it's been getting a lot of notoriety, especially in Europe, that this so-called shadow fleet or ghost fleet, as he referred to it there, which is, I want to say, somewhere around several hundred, I think, transport ships on the ocean that move Russian produce, especially oil and gas. If the United States or Europe goes after and starts seizing these assets on the open sea, will that stop Russia's ability to fund its war?
Well, maybe some people would prefer to live in this in general's world. Maybe it's easier for them to hide there, hide in front of the bare truth. But the truth is different, and I think that all these claims, they just don't stand any elementary fact check. By the way, you use the term, and not only you, but many people use the term shadow fleet. I really don't understand what it is. There is no such notion in international law. We all remember as when French stopped some vessels claiming that it is part of the shadow fleet, saying it's with very big degree of certainty, and then they had to let it go because it had no relations to whatever activity that they claimed it should be. Nobody, of course, apologized for this. There were attempts by Estonia also to claim that some of the tankers are this kind of a shadow fleet. This is something that was invented. This term is absolutely vague, and I don't think that serious specialists really would echo this term because of its vagueness. As for the sanctions, again, my country has learned how to live under sanctions, and our economy has adopted to this. There are countries that are interested in buying our energy resources, and they have independent foreign policies, and they don't seem to be willing to kind of yield to pressure because of some political calculations of certain people, because they have economic interests of their own citizens, and the well-being of their countries is at stake. And of course, there can be harsher sanctions, there can be some other measures, but it will be equal to shooting into US's own foot, or maybe both feet, because it will backfire. It will increase the prices of oil on the market. It will trigger other adverse effects that the US economy was very much hoping to avoid. So I don't know who will benefit from it. And again, I hope that around President Trump there are sane people who have a clear and not distorted and ideological analysis of what is happening, and they might give him good advice on what to do and what not to do from the perspective of U.S. interests, not Russian interests, but first and foremost U.S. interests.
And is there a pain point? Let's say whether it's this alleged shadow fleet, however defined by the West, if they interdict, especially Russian ships that are transporting oil and gas to these customers you just mentioned, or they just have these sanctions on the two big oil companies that have just been placed on there, is there enough pain that can be brought to bear on Russia that would cause Putin to say, all right, we need to rethink our focus on root causes, for example, and we'll just consider ending the war here on the current line of contact?
Well, we are now in a very hypothetical field, I would say. And again, it's hard for me to understand what is shadow fleet, because as far as I can guess, judge from the statements of different politicians, including President Macron, he's not meaning Russian vessels by this shadow fleet. He's meaning vessels with other jurisdiction carrying allegedly Russian oil. But again, in practical terms, it's very hard to make such a choice and to clearly define what is the vessel, what is it doing, what kind of oil it is carrying, and so on and so forth. So, of course, we can, as a measure, U.S. And the others can stop any transportation of oil by vessels. Maybe that will be efficient from this point of view. But how will it affect world energy markets? I don't think that many people would welcome this move.
And I know you're about out of time here, so last question. If Russia doesn't get the root causes addressed as they were asking for in the special military operation, do they have the capacity and the willpower that they will physically go into eventually a military victory on the battlefield, or will this turn into some kind of frozen conflict?
Well, I think that's what is happening. And if you really analyze the news from the battlefield, you will see that our troops are advancing, regardless of the fact that there are a lot of those who claim that the advance is very slow, that Russia is a paper tiger, and all these kind of things. But serious experts have to admit that the advancement is rather remarkable, given the fact that we are now dealing with a very fortified Ukrainian position, which we are prepared for many, many years, and heavily fortified. And I don't know how things will develop in 1 or 2 months' time. We'll see, and we'll come back to this. But I don't think that there is any doubt that Ukraine is losing, and that the only strategy so far for the West, and especially for the European sponsors of the Kyiv regime, would be to slow down this trend, which is, of course, something that is impossible to be done. So we'll see how it will develop. And coming back to what we want from as a result of our special military operation, we repeatedly said that we want to have a normal country on our borders. We don't want to have anti-Russia. So Ukraine was turned into anti-Russia after the illegal in unconstitutional Maidan coup in 2014. We don't want to have a nationalist hornet's nest at our borders. We will not tolerate it. So it matters very much to us of how the remainder of Ukraine will look like, what kind of laws there would be, what kind of people will govern it in terms of how they formulate their attitude towards Russia, towards Russian-speaking population, which is still very numerous in Ukraine. All these things will be taken into account, and this is an important factor to process for those who claim that ceasefire and stopping of hostilities would be a solution. No, it will not be, because there are no absolutely guarantees that the remainder of Ukraine would be different from what the Kyiv regime did in Ukraine before February 2022. And this is a big question. It should be addressed. It should be tackled. And there should be some practical answers to our questions, which are quite numerous.
Well, as you say, we're going to continue to see how these things develop and hope to have you back here in another couple of months as we see whatever has been happening next and get your view on that. We really appreciate, sure, Mr. Ambassador, your time today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we will see you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.